I want to welcome everyone here this afternoon to our weekend poetry series sponsored by the Friends of the Concord Free Public Library. This afternoon, we are filming the reading of the two poets, and also for the first time, we're going to attempt to podcast it because we realize that over the years, we've had so many wonderful poets, and most interestingly, the questions and answers that follow from the audience members have been just some of the most marvelous, enthralling parts of these experiences. So we're hoping to begin to start capturing those on podcasts. So we'll see how it works today. But again, welcome to you all. I'm Glenn Mitchell, one of the many friends that helped to support and to run this series. And this afternoon, we're going to listen to the enthralling poetry of Ellen Steinbaum and June Bysshe. And after both poets read, we'll have questions and answer session, and in turn followed by a book signing reception with good cheer and conversation that we hope all of you will stay and participate in. Ellen Steinbaum. Some of us, including myself, I think may have first come to know Ellen Steinbaum through her vividly written columns over the last decade for the Boston Globe on writers and poets. She also maintains her own fascinating blog, as well as contributing to, currently, as a guest blogger for an online literary journal entitled Melusine. She's been published widely, and one of her poems was nominated for the Pushcart Prize, and one of her poems has also been read by Garrison Keillor on his national public radio program, The Writer's Almanac. Of her first book of poetry, it's been said that this collection of poems should be read in the worn, comfortable seat of your favorite chair, with perhaps a glass of wine or a complacent cat purring beside you. It is poetry to quietly contemplate by a woman who is a veteran of life. It should be required reading for those of us in the first half of the roller coaster ride. And those words by poet and editor of Ibbotson Press, Doug Holder. Of her second book of poetry, Container Gardening, the poet Linda Paston, who's also read here at the library, has said this: "Beneath the impeccably controlled surfaces of these poems lies the hidden knowledge of dangers past and to come. Container Gardening gives us illuminating glimpses of a life bravely lived." And poet Lloyd Schwartz, in his praise, has said of that same volume, "Ellen Steinbaum is a poet of muted grief and quiet acceptance and hope. In Container Gardening, the losses we suffer, private, public, political, natural, are universal." Let's all welcome Ellen Steinbaum to the Concord Library.
Thank you so much. You want to hook me up? Hook me up. Beam me up. A slight pause for technology. Thank you.
Just put your hand outside that. So.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much, Glenn. And the Friends of the Library and June for inviting me to read, and June for the great privilege of reading with you, and to all of you who decided to come inside on this wonderful, wonderful, beautiful, sunny day. This day was kind of reminding me a little of that maybe we will have summer one of these days, so I thought I would start with a poem that reminds me of summer. This was a description of a photograph that my family took when we were all together at the seashore, and we were all lined up along the edge of the shore, and the photographer was taking the picture. This is called Standing at the Shore. Afterwards, we will look at it and say, this was when we still, or this was before. But then we will not be at that same soft moment, grouped in pastel shirts. The children, giddy with being on the beach at nearly bedtime, digging their toes into the sand, wild to escape to the waves, get their clothes wet. Looking back, we may see the messy instant of everyone trying to be perfect. Or we may see it framed by then, glowing, that minute when we did not know where we would be looking back from. And this is another photograph poem, this one about my mother. It's called One Photograph. She will not become my mother for another 30 years. Her husband waits a quarter century into her future, and with him the war, letters, wounds. Their home is not yet built. The molecules and minutes of rooms and days hang in the air. What is here at this moment is the child with her sisters, all in white eyelet dresses their mother has sewn, each dress slightly different. In front, the two youngest sit, hands clasped. She and the eldest stand behind them. Maybe their mother sits nearby, proudly urging them into easy expressions, formal, not quite smiles. The child who will be my mother is 7, maybe 8, staring solemnly ahead, looking for some wanted thing. Not the simple, hard longing for the birthday bicycle or prize behind the glass for which small, damp change is counted out, but for what she cannot name. What would warm her, fill her like soup, will flicker always out of reach. All of that is unknown at the moment of the photograph. At that instant, perhaps she is thinking, if she concentrates, watches hard enough, it will be there soon, maybe just after the shutter clicks. And that one leads me on to the one that actually Garrison Keillor read on Writer's Almanac, which I was so excited about. This is called Letter Home, and it's about my parents. I love you forever, my father's letter tells her, for 49 pages from the troop ship crossing the Atlantic before they'd ever heard of Anzio. He misses her, the letter says, counting out days of boredom, seasickness and changing weather, poker games played for matches when cash and cigarettes ran out, a Red Cross package, soap, cards, a mystery book he traded away for the rubaiyat a bunkmate didn't want. He stood night watch and thought of her. Don't forget the payment for insurance, he says. My mother waits at home with me, waits for the letter he writes day by day, moving farther across the ravenous ocean. Excuse me. She will get it in 3 months. And her fingers will smooth the army stationery to suede. He will come home, stand beside her in the photograph, leaning on crutches, holding me against the rough wool of his jacket. He will sit alone and listen to Aida, and they will pick up their interrupted lives. Years later, she will show her grandchildren a yellow envelope with 49 wilted pages, telling her of shimmering sequins on the water, the moonlight catching sudden phosphorescence, the churned wake that stretched a silver trail. I'm going to do a couple from my first book. And this, as you picked up from the introduction from Glenn, was very specifically about loss. It was a collection that I wrote during the illness and after the death of my first husband. This is called Fresh Diagnosis. It has been 3 weeks since we fell down the rabbit hole. 3 weeks of testing, of waiting, of no good news. Tulips and freesias wilt in their glass vases. Roses droop and wither in full bloom, while I cull hardy alstroemeria for your bedside bouquets. This will not be cured. The doctor's voice is soft. He wants to be sure I understand. I understand. And this is called Yellow. It's about an ill-advised venture that I took upon myself to try. During the time when my husband was ill, I guess it mattered to me very much that I felt that I could do things by myself. So I decided, God knows why, to paint my kitchen. And it didn't turn out too well, but it was an adventure. Yellow. I painted my kitchen yellow. I painted my kitchen taxi cab, yellow submarine, bunch of ripe bananas, knock your shoes off yellow. Just woke up one day and needed yellow. At the paint store, I said, I want to paint my kitchen yellow, this yellow. The man's hand wavered, just a trace as it hovered above the color chip. This will be very bright, he said. That's the one I want. I bought the paint, the brush, the roller. I taped the edges and slathered on two coats. It is very, very yellow. Standing in my kitchen is like being inside the yolk of an egg. Like lying in a meadow with a thousand dandelions around me, holding their faces to the sky, their manes of tiny petals ruffled and beaming, undaunted even while they're being trampled in the outfield. Strong enough, bright yellow enough to blaze away the darkness, Van Gogh's wild flame of sunflowers dancing in exuberant madness. Monet's mantra of grain stacks shimmering in the silent light. Alone in my kitchen, my silly color kitchen too bright for shadow, I am folded into yellow, wrapped in the sun, drawn close to its magnetic and unquiet heart, pierced by its searing rays that purify what is laid on the altar. What is laid on the altar is what time has in store for us, an allotment of days stacked like firewood, neat stacks of firewood destined to burn into nothingness, burn down to an ending that will snap me in two like a stalk of celery, pale, yellowed celery, with only thin strings to bridge the empty space. After I realized that I could hardly enter that room, it was so bright, I sponged it all down again so it was a little better. Homesteading. I am spreading out, stretching my reach to occupy new territory. I am pouring into drawers, taking over space. Only small encroachments first, a shelf of the medicine chest where the aftershave and razors used to be, and soon I own the cabinet and the closet where my shoes now toe the mark his shoes made, and my scarves drape over the tie rack, and my clothes slowly creep to his closet from mine, where barren inches yawn between the lonesome shirts. In the sudden space of my nearly empty closet, I am stunned, and for a moment can't remember which of us is gone. This is called The Question. You do not choose. This is the one you are given, the one that will be yours always. This will be the mote at the edge of your vision, the lost puzzle piece, the rough tooth edge. This is the question that will be the whisper in your ear, the rhythm of your breathing. The answer is in the locked drawer, the one that has no key. This is the title poem for this book, Container Gardening. Geranium, hosta, coleus, lantana, beginner's garden, pieced from advice and no-fail nursery specials, planted in recipe soil, made earth, lugged home in separate bags, and measured out on careful plastic. Two stories up, they settle into air, sip water doled out by the cup, dare not drip on downstairs neighbors. No chance rocks here or beneficial insects, glass shards, arrowheads, no earthworms crawl among these roots. No weeds invade, and partial shade is all I have to offer. I place each plant precisely, add fertilizer, make the rain, note blossomings and witherings, apply attention, plainest form of love. Still, I feel no gift for this, distrust each curling leaf. No, when I banish from this garden, the fall from grace is mine. Most beautiful words. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm not going to read this. Sorry. I just want to look up this one thing. This is the one I want to read. Distant Relation, which is actually a true story. A woman in Brazil may or may not be my cousin. Sends photographs, would I please see if anyone looks familiar? And there, on my screen, on my desk, the Atlantic City beach, right behind them, the czar and his war decades in the past, my grandparents, looking at someone from Brazil who holds a camera. A hemisphere away, the maybe cousin brings fruit compote to a family dinner, and given the way things work, the way that dust motes float from place to place, drift down around the world, the silt on my spring windowsill may have been in Montana just last month, or on a Chinese breeze a century ago. Blown from the Sahara, Kalahari, Minsk, or Mainz, or Patagonia in the Middle Ages, and on some yet-to-be-imagined street, may brush the cheek of my great-great-grandchild or of someone in Brazil who holds a camera. I know exactly where these things are, and yet, sometimes not. This one is called The Boat from Irianjaya, and all the place names in it are in Southeast Asia. And this is also based on a story someone told me, just about how randomly our lives work out, how we take a left turn instead of a right turn, and all of a sudden, things happen that wouldn't have happened, and things don't happen that would have happened. The boat from Irianjaya never came. If it had, he would not have taken the flight to Kuching, where he met the man who spoke to him of Langkawi, where he saw the photograph that drew him to Alor Star, where he met the woman who came home with him to Boston, where they bought the house, where they raised the children, who would have been different children in a different house if the boat from Irianjaya had arrived. Huh.
adjustments. I cut a piece of brown paper the size of the picture, she tells her companion at the table next to mine. Then I tape it to the wall, move it to find the right place. How else can you hang a picture when you live alone? I sip my tea, think of the antique lace blouse bought on a drizzly day along the Loire. I held it to my raincoat, gambled on the size, handed over crazy francs, wore it often, sleeve ends ruffled on my wrists. He would fumble with the covered buttons, down the back, high collar to peplum waist. Afterwards, I wore it once, knocking on a neighbor's door for buttoning. In the bathroom after dinner, a friend undid the back. I drove home with the blouse drooping loose beneath my coat. For me, one of those unexpected turning left instead of turning right moments was that a mutual friend introduced me to the man I married this past August. And so I have a bunch of little newly written love poems that I'm going to read too. This one is the one that was just nominated for a Pushcart Prize, which I'm so excited and proud of, and humbled and surprised by. This is the poem I will not show him, though he is an eager reader, wants to love my words, and is quick with knowing comments. But this is the poem about how, when we are cooking side by side and rain is beating loud on the windows, we turn the music up. Or how he laughs and pulls me to him, talks to me in couple code, or turns the heat up higher than he likes because he knows I'm always cold. And how on one St. John morning, I saw him up early in his robe, sprinkling sugar on the window ledge so I could wake to see a row of bright banana quits feast in front of me before they flew away. This is, as you would probably guess anyway, but I figure I'll give a hint here. Think the forever stamps, you know, the ones that don't go up in price all the time. Okay. This is called 100 Forevers. He's bought the wrong ones, asked me to take them back, and so I slide the puny roll of 42s, those undistinguished flags, across the counter, ask, can I exchange this? And for just $2 more, have 100 forevers. Forever. Not, we know, a word to be believed. A note held on past breath, the Dennis Beach beyond the oyster beds where sand blurs into fog, or the unlikeliness of this, our stunned contentment that has not as yet eroded into boredom, irritation, those sodden, all too human states that could unspangle our small future. But the enormity turns doubt aside in this quantity, no option but belief. A couple of years ago, I was at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, which is where I met June. And there was a visual artist who before she even started her work, kind of created this whole little environment for herself. And I always get a lot of inspiration from visual artists. And so this is called In Anne's Studio. Before even the first line is drawn is order. Each twig breathes, and each seed pod lies calm in its deliberate space. Spare, but like those Dutch still lifes with ripe fruit, fly, fat rabbit still furred with its quickness, and light shining down just so on polished grapes, draped cloth. This too, what the world is made of. Leaves, paper shreds, stones, a meditation of things, each object in its honored place, showing us that what is holy in this life is noticing.
since tonight is the Oscars, I have one movie reference poem, so I'm reading it. The Rose from Beauty and the Beast. It's an old movie reference poem. The Rose from Beauty and the Beast. Like the rose from the movie Beauty and the Beast, I tell him, but he has not seen Beauty and the Beast, not seen that rose under glass, marking the time when, if the Beast finds true love, he can become a handsome prince again. That rose with the petals slowly, slowly dropping away, the last one hanging on impossibly long. But he has not seen this. He has only gone into the garden, cut one huge and perfect rose, full blown, now 2 weeks old at least, in the vase on my nightstand, where I have not even remembered to change the water. But the rose is, beyond all expectation, still open, full, with every petal stretched out and not one yet drooping, dropping, browning at an edge or showing any other sign of coming to an end. And I'm going to end with two poems, one of which I think of as very celebratory, and the other, which is a little poem that when one of my daughters was getting married, she had asked me to write a poem. So this is the one that I came up with, and it felt like what I wished for them, but also, as I think of it, what I wish for all of us. So this one is called It Was the World. This was brought to mind and kind of started being written because of an advertising sign that I remembered from my childhood, which maybe many of you will remember too. It was the world, the whole world, hanging large and red over the boardwalk, lights blinking their way down its curve. Sherwin-Williams paints cover the earth. Cover the earth in glittering lights, in magic, blinking childhood lights, a kind of Sherwin-Williams grace, a Sherwin-Williams blessedness, blinking down the curve of the world, blinking down to cover the earth. Cover the earth in blinking lights, in fine white sand, in blue-white sand crabs, sofa cushions, outdoor concerts. Cover the earth in rainy mornings, hot soup, heavy quilts, scent of geranium leaves, ripe pears sliced on flowered china plates, charms candy in my grandmother's handbag, the war over and my father coming home, and all the brilliant, vibrant, shimmering colors, emerald, scarlet, midnight blue, vermilion, topaz, saffron, every color pouring out to cover the earth in flowers, the drawings of children, pied horses, Bengal tigers, giant redwoods, sparkling fish. Cover the earth, cover the earth. Now begins the dailiness. More days, if we are lucky, than we will think to count, piling up like shelter at our door. Feathered twigs and bits of string will weave day upon day, and we will lean unthinking on this solidness, rest within the wonder of this gift. Thank you.
To be de-vampired.
Here.
This is, it's called a vampire clip, so I'm now no longer a vampire. Again, thank you, Ellen. It's a great pleasure for me to now introduce a friend, colleague, and a person that I've worked with over the past many years in helping to coordinate this poetry series, and I'm looking forward to many more years doing the same. And I'm speaking about June Bysshe. Many of us here today know June in many different ways, as a good friend, as a cheery companion, and along all of those paths of knowing June better and better is the writing that she's done over the many years. We know her as an essayist, as a critic, in a former life as a dramatist, but today we're going to enjoy her as a poet. And let me say a few things that perhaps some of us don't know about her poetry and her expertise in that regard. She's published one book of poems, two chapbooks, and dozens of essays and book reviews. She's a former interviewer at WGBH. She's published in the Boston Globe and the Boston Magazine. And her interviews with John Cheever and Seamus Heaney have been reprinted in books. And her essay, The Wolf, was named a notable essay in Best Essays of 1998. She has won fellowships to the Virginia Center for the Arts and to Stone Coast, as well as to the Wellesleyan Writers Conference. And her book, Fatherless Woman, won the Cape Cod Literary Press Poetry Award. Her poems have been read on Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac, and they've appeared in several anthologies as well. Let's all welcome June Bysshe.
Anybody who wants to stand up and stretch while I'm getting my microphone, please do. My son is filming it, so.
Just put this on here.
In the middle of my life, I began to see that life was a journey toward insight, became nocturnal, grew to love the night, pulled out all the hairpins of regret, and let my life fall free. Along the way, I began to prefer the description of a forest to a forest, saw that my faith was a dead star. I could still get light from it. And just when I thought there were no more surprises for me, found poetry. I want to thank you all for coming, and a special thank you at this reading, sorry, a little short of breath here. A special thank you to Glenn Mitchell. I think we all owe her a tremendous round of applause for taking charge of the Concord Poetry Festival. Glenn, will you stand up? She has done this single-handedly. In this Concord Poetry Series, we have had almost every major poet read at the Concord Library. And we are very proud of the last 10 years, and we've had a great time. We've had from Seamus Heaney to Jory Graham to Robert Kinsky, and getting to know all of these poets has reminded me of a little ditty by Emily Cope, which you probably all know. I used to think all poets were Byronic, mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And then I met a few, and it's ironic. They're about as Byronic as a ginless tonic. But as bland as a pension plan. Okay, I'm going to be reading from, a lot of my poems are going to be from the book Fatherless Woman, published in 2004. And the first one I'm going to read, we have something in common, Ellen and I, because we've both been read on Garrison Keillor's show, the Writer's Almanac, and I happen to have a crush on Garrison Keillor. But the first poem that he read of mine, he's read three so far, and the first one that he read was called Aunt Bobby. But the only thing is, he pronounced it aunt. So there were the rhymes I had to think of.
aslant is one of the words. And when I was growing up, my aunts were these very sophisticated Norwegian beauties, and they all wanted to be called Aunt Mabel and Aunt Edith. And so I got used to calling them aunts. So when I heard it on the radio program, I had a little bit of a problem with it. But here's the poem. Aunt Bobby. My favorite aunt was unmarried, half deaf, and lived alone in a smoke-filled room in the Curtis Hotel in Minneapolis. Once beautiful, she still had her vanity. Her hip, mangled in surgery, gave her a spasmodic gait. She flapped down Oakland Avenue to visit us like a tall crane who'd had a few. I loved the sight of her. Ran to the frazzled, overpermed head, the two bright ruby lips, the overstrong perfume. For all the appearances of inutile femininity, she was to me a half divinity. The auntness of aunts, or the auntness of aunts, their bemused, had askance objectivity. They belong to no one and to everyone, and they can offer a child another reality. How many times she took me home to her apartment, hoping to give my busy mother a quick reprieve, handed me a pencil and a drawing pad, then made me feel like Michelangelo. Now, thinking back, I wish I had given back just half of what she gave to me. Now, I'm going to, Garrison Keillor, as you know, decided to move back to Minnesota, as he said, because to resume the life of a shy person. Because he decided that when he was living in New York, he was saying things that he didn't really mean, and that you would never say in Minnesota. So, every once in a while, I think I would like to go back to Minnesota and resume the life of a shy person, but it's too late. So, this next poem is one of my newer poems. It has been published, it was just recently published in the Harvard Review. It's called In Muir Woods, and some of you have been to Muir Woods in California, and you probably know that it is an unbelievable, holy spot. In this poem, I mention my friend. I'm thinking of my friend who died not long ago. Last night, a giant redwood fell, either from old age, disease, or sometimes they just give up, the ranger said. Listen, I was in the woods. I heard it too. Like my own death falling inside of me. Here in the last of the old growth forests, where some trees are still virginal and some older than Moses, I thought then of you. You are not the one dying, you said to me, and I quoted to you from Montaigne that death was not a proper object of fear, but only the end of life. What is a proper object of fear then, you said, and I said, death of the heart. But life, you said, was everything, and you were in love with that beautiful lie. Sometimes these trees send out all their sap at once, making them vulnerable. Sometimes they grow burrows of anxiety. Look, the ranger said to us, the bark is so wet because the tree drinks hundreds of gallons of water a day from the fog that rolls in over the Golden Gate Bridge. That bridge, which is so beautiful and which holds such promise for tomorrow, with its blue shimmering bay. Every day now when I see the fog, I think of you, and then I can almost feel it cover me with that enveloping mist. I can almost feel the branches of the redwood being kissed by its cold ministrations. I would, if I could, stand here all day like these trees, but my heart is so sore, it is ready to burst. And I am filled suddenly with a wild and insatiable thirst.
Now, with my recent illness, I've been reading a lot of John Donne's holy sonnets. They're wonderful. One of them begins, "Thou hast made me, and shall thy work decay? Repair me now, for now my end doth haste." Oh, I forgot to copy the rest. But anyway, there's another modern poem on illness that's quite wonderful. "The cells divide, the cells that will not die, divide so well, and so they multiply." It begins like that. It's a lovely poem. But from my book, Fatherless Woman, and I promise not to read too many depressing poems. This one is not about illness. It's called Amaryllis. And I guess I decided to read it because I got a couple of letters about it. "You will bloom in spite of all benign neglect, all screened in rooms. Out here on the porch, your red bugle petals bugle out as if to say, you will bloom. In spite of this rain-filled day, this gloom, the birds having already quit the feeder, having lost their taste for sunflower seeds, the lawn having already turned to yellow, and it's only June. Coming upon you, I find your bright flower balancing on that thick green stem with all the insouciance of young girls who insist upon mattering." Emily Dickinson had that insouciance too, and she too insisted upon mattering, although one critic called her that little homekeeping person, although she too was late flowering and hid herself like you for such a long, long time. Okay. "Poetry adds to the stock of reality," said Randall Jarrell. I love that sentence. It means a lot to me. He was one of the great poetry critics. He said, "The best poetry tries to capture, or we capture, the silences in Beethoven, or the caesuras in Yeats." The next poem will be, this is a new poem. This was published in Cape Cod Women. "The Apollo Club Concert. Once a year, my mother would leave my older sister with the other children and take me to an Apollo Club concert. It was always a frigid Minnesota night, and we had to ride for a long time on the downtown bus, mother in her teddy bear coat and me in my winter leggings. We sat in the hushed theater in Minneapolis while the men's choir sang all her favorite songs, Old Man River and I Love You, Porgy. And I ate the chocolate-covered raisins she always bought me. Although she knew nothing about Apollo, she knew a lot about dying gods, about being left behind at 28 with four small children, a welfare mother in a threadbare coat and one pair of nylons. I remember the brass railings at the Schubert Theater, the hushed silence in the great hall as the men's voices rang out in harmony. Oh, the men. So many of them, and each one seemed to be my father, who died at 36 of spinal meningitis. Even now, at 60, I can hear them singing. The small gods of the universe in their 50s crew cuts, their double-breasted blue coats, the brave young gentlemen fathers of the past, and the one who died gasping for breath in an oxygen mask, the breeze from the window blowing his brown hair softly." The only reason I know that you can have a window open while you're in an oxygen mask is because that's the only little bit of information that my aunts were able to tell me about my father's death, which in fact was caused by an overdose of sulfa tablets while they were trying to save his life. Okay. see how we're doing on time here. I don't want to go over. Let's call it yard sale. As you know, we lived in Concord and raised our children here, and now we live in Cambridge. Yard sale. While I was spreading the old lace out in the sun to whiten and dry, someone came by, stopped to examine it with careful and tentative hands. Nobody knows just how long things will last. While I was busily counting the coins, so much disappeared, gone into strange hands. The black iron horses you had in a pair and wanted to sell, but put out in the end, hated to sell, but put out in the end. Someone came up to me simply to ask how much I wanted for a pair of old chairs. I would have given my whole life to know just what was worth having and what was not. I couldn't say. Only sometimes at night, I sat sultanic among my own things, as happy and smug as a king. Neighbors arrived, began parking their cars, walking all over my lawn. Some of them hadn't been over for years. I watched as they stood, eyeing my past. There was my life, all spread out in the sun, and what was the sum of it? Dead poems that nobody would read. The children grown and gone, no one to feed. The dog's ashes still unburied. Oh, do not let me be old before I am wise, said King Lear. What I miss the most in Concord is the house in Concord, and of course I miss this beautiful town. I felt the presence of Emerson and Thoreau there every day, and it was there that I began to write poetry at a rather late date. Emerson once wrote, "Pay attention to your thoughts and write them down, because someday you will find them in someone else's book, coming back to you with a kind of alienated majesty." I love that, alienated majesty. Faith. This is a new poem. This has been published. I still don't have another book, but I do have poems published in little journals. This is called Faith. Every day I walk into the square, and every day there are more and more homeless people, and the streets are dirtier than the day before, and as though the world were changing before my eyes. And every day I walk down to Bow and Arrow Street towards St. Paul's Church. But the church seems to be disappearing, and sometimes I can't find God when I go inside, but the yearning is still there. The longing to go down on my knees and to say, please help me in my disbelief. Because every day I fear the loss of my faith. And the idea that poetry is beginning to take its place, and I do not know if I want to go down on my knees to poetry. A new poem. Emerson himself wrote that literature is a kind of a branch of religion and always participates in its character. The true poet shares the same inspiration as the prophet. Now, I think I have time for one more. This one is called Skunks. And I'm sorry, these are so disorganized, but I am disorganized. We have a skunk who lives beneath our house. This morning, I stepped out onto the deck and into the cold, sharp morning air, and the cold, sharp scent of a skunk lurking nearby, close enough to remind me that some are up early. Some are up early, sorting through life's detritus, hoping to uncover its purpose or meaning. Some are reconnoitering, hoping to discover just who is the enemy, who the friend. Last night, I sat reading poems from a new anthology. And after a while, I put the book down, lowered my head, my heart aching. I was filled with the most delicious melancholy, was transported to a world of beauty and sorrow. And I saw then how much we need sadness, and how sometimes reading poetry, you come upon a sudden, sharp whiff of truth, and it enters your life, it hurts you, and it can even set you free.
Thank you, June. A wonderful, wonderful reading for both of the poets. And now I would like us all to pose some interesting questions that one or both poets might want to respond to or reflect upon. And perhaps we have a few questions in turn. So I'd like to have both poets stand up here. And after you ask a question, I'm going to ask whoever you're intending it to repeat the question so we can hear it beyond. And
I just want to say thank you to both of you. Everything you read was so intimate and meaningful and moving. I'm always in tears. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. I'm always so in awe of people who bring themselves to the experience of hearing or reading poems enough to be that moved. Thank you.
And I'm very grateful to all of you for turning up, because I know it's not fun to give up 2 hours on a Sunday, the most beautiful Sunday in the year, and to sit inside. You've been wonderful. I don't think there are any questions. I mean, what's there to ask? I think these people want to go outside.
Stefan has a question.
I have a question for Ellen.
Oh, it was just astounding. The question was more about the picture from Brazil. A male cousin of mine, who of course still has the family name, got an email, and he sent it around to everybody and said, you know, here's this email from somebody. Let's see if this looks familiar. And we discovered another side of my great-great-grandparents' family. The family that's here is all my great-great-grandfather's side, and seems that my great-great-grandmother's side of the family all went to Brazil. There's as large a family, if not larger, in Brazil, and it was very astounding to suddenly find these people that we're connected to over thousands of miles that, just randomly.
Questions. Other questions? The craft or the connections of poetry to other parts of one's life?
I might want to buy books if you want to have them.
I have a question for June. Come over here, June. One of the things that continually surprises and makes me so happy is to hear how you make connections to other poets and other forms of literature. Could you tell us a little bit about the poets, the contemporary poets that you're currently especially fond of and that you think that we should not fail to be reading ourselves?
That's a very good question. I happen to be a great Mary Oliver fan, and I can't think of anybody that I like more than Mary Oliver and Jane Kenyon and poets like that. I like poems that are totally understandable, but I think one of the things that people often ask me when I was teaching poetry workshops at the Cambridge Adult Ed, as a matter of fact, one of my students is here, and is writing poems, they would say, how did you decide to write poetry? And I think it was the idea that you could get so much power in the short space of the small space. It was just completely threw me when I heard people reading two words or like a short little aphorism like, I was too far out in my life and not waving but drowning. And I heard that and it was just like my heart was just breaking. People in the workshops at Wesleyan were just weeping when they would hear something like that. And I remember what they said about Keats, that he was a young man, and one day he said, see if I can remember, he read in Spencer, the sea shouldering whales. He just read three words, and he fell to sobbing. Because if you're interested in language, you will understand what's happening when someone says sea shouldering. First of all, to describe a whale, they're all shoulders, aren't they? And to say, to make it even more succinct, is to say that they are shouldering the sea. And so within three words, you have a picture that is so powerful. And they said he couldn't get over this, having read it in Spencer's The Faerie Queen. And so the sea shouldering whales became a little clue for me when I saw that the more compact you can make a phrase, the more explosive and powerful it is. I'm going to relinquish this to you. One of the things that Emily Dickinson says is, you know, I cannot live with you. That would be life. I heard this, I read it. I cannot live with you. That would be life. And it was so heartbreaking to me. And life is over there behind a shelf. Well, you know the whole story of Emily Dickinson. And, you know, she is the master of this kind of thing where she's able to put into words the most heartbreaking. You know, she'll say, it was not death, for I stood up. And all the dead lie down. So she's talking about depression. It was not death, for I stood up. And all the dead lie down. I mean, that had a very, but you see, it doesn't work for everybody, so I should stop here.
Actually, I'm not going to add anything. This is wonderful and just an example of why June is not only a wonderful poet, but a wonderful teacher.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions, or shall we get up and have good cheer, conversation, and some book signing? Please.
Does a poem come to you all at once? Or does it come in a snippet and then you...
Well, the truth is there are occasional poems like the...
Repeat the question.
Oh, the question is, does the poem come to you all at once? Most of the poems in Follow This Woman took 10 years to write because I just kept going back to them. And I was, you know, by the time I published them, I was old. And so don't give up, those of you who are, you know, starting out. But the truth is, occasionally a poem will come to me, like that little poem, Faith, I do not know if I want to go down on my knees to poetry. That came to me all at once, and I just said, it's spontaneous, I'm going to just leave it, I'm not going to revise it. Because sometimes you start revising and you lose the spontaneity. How about you?
I think it happens in different ways with different poems. Sometimes it starts with an image that just kind of, you just know it's there and just needs to be written down. And more often than not, it's something that needs to be worked over and over and over, over weeks or months or years.
That's true.
I think perhaps we're ready to have some refreshments and conversation, and thank you all for coming. And Stefan is in the next room, where a lot of the other author books are. And please continue to come to these wonderful poetry readings. This is what the friends love to see. Thank you for being here.
What is the next one?
The next one is next month, and I don't have the date in front of me. Dan Chiasson. Thank you. April the 11th, Dan Chiasson, poetry for the Paris Review, poetry editor. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, Joanne said to give you regards.